Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark.
The Strangest Stories, Volume 8, Story Number 1. This happened back in 2016. I was just out of the military on a 3-year enlistment and had been hired by a petroleum pipeline company and transferred to New Mexico. We were staying there weekends with our parents in Midland, Texas to save money, then staying in a small motel in Lovington, New Mexico during the week while I worked and my wife looked for a home to buy. On a late Sunday night, while returning to Lovington from Midland for the following work week, we were taking our usual oil field back road shortcut. Part of the shortcut was the fact that the back road was almost completely straight for 70 miles and only had 3 paved crossroads. Bottom line, I had a fast car and no smokies to worry about, so I could drive 90 miles without much worry. My wife was asleep in the passenger seat up front, and my 3-year-old son was asleep in the back seat on a makeshift bed. I was clipping along between 90 and 100 miles an hour and listening to the radio. It was pitch dark night. All of a sudden, my wife sits up almost like in a trance. It reminded me of Frankenstein stiffly sitting up from his operating table after being pieced together. It was so strange, it scared me a little, but then creeped me out even further when in a very weird, strange voice said, "Slow down." It shook me up, so I slowed to about 70 miles, wondering what was up. Again in that same creepy, unfamiliar voice, she said, "Slow down." I slowed to 50. She again repeated, "Slow down." I slowed to 40. Then she said in that very strange voice, "I said, slow down." I slowed to 20. Getting very nervous, she continued with slower. I slowed to 10 miles per hour, then slammed on my brakes just in time to run into a whole herd of black Angus cattle that had gotten out of a broken down barbed wire pasture fence and were all standing around in the road and bar ditches. I hit a couple of heifer, but not hard enough to damage my car or harm them. My wife seemed to come awake and didn't understand what was happening, as though she knew nothing about the previous minutes leading up to the incident. It was a pitch dark night. The cattle were on the far side of a long curve coming into the main road leading into Seminole, Texas. If I hadn't been doing 10 miles an hour, I would have never seen them. My wife's only memory was a dream she was having that we ran into something black and she could see she and I going through the windshield and our son following in midair right behind us. And in fact, we would have, as about 30 head of cattle would have been totally wiped out, as the cows were about 10 to 15 deep as I made my way through the herd. Yes, I started listening to my wife from then on. Next story. It was August of 1979. I was 16 and in the Boy Scouts. About a dozen guys from our troop were doing a week-long backpacking trip in the Sierras on the John Muir Trail Pacific Crest Trail. Our group consisted of about 10 boys, ages 12 to 17, and 2 adults. We were hiking in and around the Yosemite High Country. The goal for the week was 50 miles, although by the time we were done, I'd actually hiked about 80 miles, most of it with a 60-plus pound pack. Oh, to be 16 again. It was quite a trip, and we experienced a little bit of everything. We lost several days' worth of food to a mama bear and her cubs, which forced us to shorten the trip by several days. We were out for a week, but had originally planned on being out for closer to 2. We also had a scout go missing on a hike, and weren't able to find him until the next morning. He was fine. He got separated from the group at dusk. He wisely stayed put once he realized he had become separated, and we found him the next morning walking down the trail. And we were also asked to help evacuate a scout from a different troop who got third-degree burns on his leg after accidentally kicking over a pot of boiling water. As I said, it was quite a trip and packed some drama, but we also experienced one genuinely weird encounter that still puzzles me to this day. After starting our hike from Tulum Meadows, 9,000 feet, and spending an easy, uneventful day acclimating ourselves, we set out on the trail. We hiked up Lyell Canyon, over 11,000 feet, Donahue Pass, and down into the upper Rush Creek drainage about 13 trail miles from our starting point. After a few spectacular miles following this narrow, rugged, and jaw-droppingly gorgeous creek, the trail entered the tree line and passed by a few pretty and fishable medium-sized Sierra lakes. Our goal for the day was Woe Lake, a beautiful granite-rimmed lake that sits about 9,400 feet. It's in a typical high Sierra glacial valley, framed on either side by ridges that climb to a bit over 10,000 feet. It was midday when we arrived, and we skirted around the lake looking for a good place to make camp. As we did, we saw that we weren't the only people at this lake. There was also a group of four adult males, probably in their mid-30s, quietly gathered on a flat granite slab near the shore. They eyed us warily, and once we saw them, our eyes grew big, as two of the men were wearing full scuba setups, fins, wetsuits, and tanks. But next to them, spread flat on the granite, was a 10x10 red cross, made from two red fabric strips, each about 6 inches wide. The cross was shaped like a plus sign, as in X marks the spot. It was not a religious symbol. It was on an exposed point next to the lake, and presumably it was meant to be seen from the air. The men didn't greet us, instead sort of glared at us. They seemed anxious, and we could tell from their body language they didn't want us around. I didn't notice any visible weapons, but I felt a sense of menace from them. We weren't sure what we had walked into, but it sure seemed like we were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Had we stumbled on an imminent drug drop? A law enforcement training exercise? A crazy Pacific Crest Trail resupply? Something else? We couldn't tell what the divers were hoping to pull from the lake, but it was clear we were intruding on their plans. Some of the kids began to loudly comment and speculate about the situation, but doing it way too loudly for our collective safety. Our scoutmaster had seen enough, though, and quickly decided that our troop would be a lot more comfortable at another lake. He had us hightail it out of there, loudly telling us on our way out that we were headed for nearby Gem Lake, but then actually taking us to Thousand Island Lake instead, which was 2 miles in the other direction. This particular scoutmaster wasn't always this sharp, unfortunately, but to his credit, he did have his thinking cap on that day, and he got us out of there before anything bad happened to us. We got to Thousand Island Lake about 30 or 40 minutes later and made camp. We didn't have anything further to do with that group from the Woe Lake and went about the business of being a bunch of noisy teenagers on a backpacking trip. Oddly, I don't remember hearing any sort of small plane or helicopter coming by later that afternoon, so I don't know if we caused the divers to reschedule their rendezvous or there was some other explanation for what we saw. Or maybe we were too far away to hear it when it did come. I don't know, but I do know that the sight of seeing two folks in full scuba outfits preparing to dive a remote 9,400-foot Sierra Lake has stayed with me ever since. It seemed weird then, and still seems weird today. What were they diving for? Needless to say, we never found out the story behind the Woe Lake divers. Our scoutmaster reported the incident to a ranger when we returned to Tulum Meadows, but I don't know if anything came from reporting it. My own suspicion is that they were probably setting up for a drug drop. Years later, I learned that a different trail leading to Woe Lake was accessible from a remote eastern Sierra trailhead only 2 to 3 miles away from the lake. But obviously, I'll never know for sure. Definitely a strange encounter, though. This was also a location for an infamous and legendary crash of a drug-running plane that occurred in Yosemite in the winter of 1976. It's a fascinating story in its own right. The crash occurred in a different part of the park on the opposite side of the Sierra Crest from Woe Lake. Although it was only about 10 miles distance from Woe Lake in a straight line, you could not get there by traveling a straight line and via trails. The plane crash site was probably more like 20 or 30 miles away. I don't think that incident was related to what we saw. Next story. On the south and west of Houston, there are drainage bayous crisscrossing all through the countryside that serve as runoffs for subdivisions and businesses. Perhaps the most famous is Buffalo Bayou that runs through the heart of Houston to the Gulf of Mexico. It begins, however, west of Houston and starts ramping up its size in Katy. Anyway, I spent a lot of miles on my mountain bike riding the banks of these bayous, and surprisingly, there are some remote areas. By remote, I mean maybe a couple of miles of swampy, dense wood and flowing water between you and a structure. On this ride, it was hot, maybe 95 degrees and humid, and I was trying and failing to acclimate myself to the hellish summers we have here. I was freaking dying and puttering along a single track on the bank of a bayou that intersects with Buffalo Bayou. If you know the area, it is the main bayou out of Cinco Rancho that passes under Highway 99, and when this story happened, the trail was only paved to maybe Fry Road. I rounded an easy bend and noticed a lone figure hiking the trail, heading in my direction. It wasn't unusual to see someone on foot that far out, but not altogether common either. As I approached, the figure was striking in appearance and did not appear to notice that I was on a collision course. I drifted into the grass off the trail to give the person space and got a good look at them as I pedaled by. It was a very old woman wearing something like Gandalf the White in Lord of the Rings and carried a long walking stick that looked to be handcrafted from tree branch. She was old, and I mean very old, like age spots, deep wrinkles, and stark white hair. She did not acknowledge me in any way as I passed by. My befuddled stupor, I kept pedaling for maybe 100, 200 more yards and rounded another bend before my brain kicked in the logic that this person had no business being out here this far down the bayou in this heat and at that age. My grandfather had passed away from Alzheimer's that year, and I finally put the two together that she could be lost. I hammered the brakes, whipped around, and pumped the pedals back to check up on her. Within a minute or less, I rounded the bend back to the spot where I had seen her, and she was gone. I rode for at least another mile at a full clip, and no figure appeared. I turned around to check again to see if maybe she had fallen in the bayou or perhaps taken a side trail I had not seen. As I rode back slowly, my eyes scanned left and right to no avail. There were no trails in the woods, which are ridiculously thick, dense, and teeming with insects and mired in brackish puddles that you could not pay me to walk or wade through, having seen an alligator there on several occasions. I mean, this stuff was seriously mean bush. On the other side, the bayou was at least 20 feet wide, of flowing water and muddy nastiness that, again, I had seen gators in, so there was no going there either. I never saw her again. Where could she have gone? Why was she out there? Why was she dressed like that at all? All of them unanswered questions. Next story. This was back in 2014. I was working night shift in the dungeon with a 12-hour long winter shift on the basement floor of the county jail. We had an inmate in at that time who gave everyone an eerie feeling of evil whenever he was around. The guy was in for some very unpopular but not overtly wicked misdemeanors in the eyes of society and would most likely receive only county time for his misdeeds. The guy's name, while I can't list it here, may have been identical to the main character in the movie The Omen. Anyway, he had a habit of letting everyone know that he had made himself an O-board. Due to reasons associated with my personal beliefs, I won't post the O-word, but doubt it will be hard to figure it out. He was also kind enough to let everyone know that he freely and frequently had long conversations with the devil and any other entity that would talk to him. This creeped the remaining guest of the Gray Bar Hotel out to no end and concerned many of the staff. One night, I decided to take a stand for my personal values and had made up my mind that as a Christian, knowing an object of evil was in an area I was entrusted to secure and control, I could not allow said object to exist any further. I know full well the legal backlash that could have resulted against me personally and the county as a whole, but did not and do not care. In this instance, I would rather be judged by God than the man as to what I did. While the inmate was away in another part of the facility, it was his cell's turn to be searched for contraband. I was the one to do the search and did find the board rather quickly. No other contraband was located, so I finished my search and took only the board with me. I stepped outside and lit the damn thing on fire, and in doing so seemed to have pissed off at least one entity that was fond of using it. The old board was made of a sheet of notebook paper with a gel pen used to decorate the surface. A playing card torn into a triangle with a hole in the middle was used as the viewer. The eerie part about this is that as I prayed and touched the flame to this paper, it began to burn green. Unlike any paper I've ever seen where the ash turns white, this one burnt to black ash and loudly crackled as it did so, throwing sparks every few seconds. Once the board had burnt completely, I destroyed the ashes and returned inside into the control room. My partner that night let me know that the inmate knew about the destruction of his board and knew that I was the one who had taken it and destroyed it. This bothered me because he had been in another part of the jail, two locked doors away and completely cut off from any sight or sound from where his cell was. He also had no cellmates, and I had taken the board from the seg unit and destroyed it where only employees have access. To this day, I will never know if he could sense what I had done or if something had told him about it. About two or three nights later, I awoke around 2 a.m. to the feeling of being watched. I scanned my room while laying motionless in bed and saw nothing out of the ordinary. I then looked out my bedroom window and saw two red glowing non-human eyes staring at me. For reference, my bedroom window stands 6 feet off the ground. My bed is lower than the window. For eyes to be looking directly inside as they would have to be nearly 8 feet high. I locked into a staring contest with the two eyes and became so filled with a righteous anger that I felt as if I was standing toe-to-toe with this thing. I never once felt afraid. I was outraged that this thing would try to intimidate me. I continued to stare at the eyes as I ordered out in God's holy name. I then prayed as I continued to stare at the evil red eyes. They did not suddenly vanish or anything like that. Instead, they dimly went out until they finally disappeared, the glow growing weaker the longer I prayed. I got the feeling that though that this event lasted less than 10 or 15 seconds, the eyes attempted to remain defiant as they were being actively forced away. After the glow had left completely, I was washed with a sense of calm that has never been matched. There was a sense of security that I had only felt one other time. That time being the day I was practicing stalls in an airplane, and despite trying everything, including power off, I could not fall out of the sky. Next story. A story about dangers of the two-legged kind. In the early 1960s, my mother took the three of us kids on a long summer cross-country camping trip while our dad worked. He closed his business and joined us for the second half of the trip. So, this was the smart, capable woman traveling with three kids, 12 and under. We drove and saw the sights by day and camped at night. One day, we pulled into a campground in late afternoon, set up the pop tents, remember those? Set up the tarp, set up the camp stove, and either made dinner, my mom, or hung around playing, us. A man came by a few times. I vaguely remember him being friendly. It had been a long day, and I'm sure my mother didn't want to have to do anything more, but just as dusk fell, she said, "Kids, we need to leave." We packed everything up and drove out. I remember the chain over the road into the campground was secured in some way, and Mom had to get out and deal with it. She drove us a good many miles down the road to a motel where we stayed the night. I don't think we fully understood anything at the time, but in later years she would explain that the friendly man kept coming back and hanging around. First, he offered to take all three of us kids for a walk. Then, it was my two brothers. Then, it was just me. He'd take me for a paddle in his canoe. My mother decided he was bad news, and she didn't want us sleeping in a tent with him around, so she got us the heck out of there. After that, my father got her a starter pistol. It was legal, and presumably we kids wouldn't have been able to kill ourselves with it, and presumably also it might have scared off the friendly man and others like him. Two-legged critters are the most dangerous of all. Next story. When I was 18, a group of us started rafting the Big Bend National Park in West Texas. This was years before rafting became a real popular deal. The country was very wild and remote, and even very dangerous back in the 60s and 70s for the drug runners, cocaine, but mostly Mary Jane. We were using Army surplus rafts because at the time rafts weren't readily available. Folks did jugfish through some of the canyons with flat bottom boats with jet attachments or pitchfork guards in front of their boat propellers. We put in at Rio Grande Village, then had to take shelter inside the west end of Boquillas Canyon and climbed into a huge cave up the side of the canyon wall on the U.S. side. A huge thunderstorm came up really fast, and we watched bolts of lightning most of the night, and it was amplified inside the canyon. Before the heavy rain stopped, a bolt of lightning struck on the Mexican side on a piece of vertical wall, causing it to somehow break away. The splash it made falling hundreds of feet straight down into the river was really a butt-puckering moment thinking it could have hit on our side of the canyon. We proceeded the next morning and spent most of the day floating and fishing. We throw our jugs in then and see if we could hook the catfish, and we would tend to swim to the nearest bank and usually hang up on reeds. When we came out of Boquillas on the east side into some desert flats on the Mexican side and the Black Gap Game Preserve on the U.S. side, we heard Spanish shouting on both sides of the river. My father-in-law spoke fluent Tex-Mex, which is Spanish with a unique dialect, so he told us quietly to paddle over to the U.S. side and continue to move quietly through the reeds under a small bluff. He said they were moving marijuana across the river. We just stayed quiet and slowly drifted right through their deal unseen because of the high steep banks and a heavy river came. When we got about 100 yards down the river, we were discovered by someone on the Mexican side who started yelling at us to come back and talk. My father-in-law yelled back a kiss my ass in Spanish and we started paddling our butt off. Later that night, we pulled out at La Linda, Mexico, where we had left a vehicle. We did our duty and called the border patrol when we got to a phone 70 miles away. There were no cell phones back then. Over the next 10 years, we enjoyed many trips through all the Big Bend canyons and only had one more incident with drug runners, again in the same area as before. I probably would not raft Mariscal Canyon nowadays due to the border situation and the remoteness. Next story. This took place in Alabama around the year 2000. Anyway, I've always been interested in ghost stories, the paranormal, etc. I can't say I believe in any of it exactly, but I don't outright disbelieve either. I've been told stories by people I absolutely believe, and I'm always up for trying to experience something firsthand, which takes us to my story. In my early 20s, I had a friend named April who lived near a supposedly haunted place and asked if I wanted to check it out. We had to hike for about 15 or 20 minutes to get there. It turned out to be a hill overlooking train tracks. There was an old plot of concrete at the top of a leveled-off hill, then it dropped off about 50 feet straight down to the tracks. April said she had heard that it used to be used for loading coal onto trains. I don't know. This was all in a clearing in the woods, kind of a big circle, with forest round in all directions. So we were sitting on the concrete platform, the legs dangling off and looking around. We only knew the place had a reputation for being haunted, no specifics, so we didn't really know what to be looking for. I was talking about something when April all of a sudden said, "What is that?" and pointed to my left. I turned and saw a faint blue light at the tree line about 100 yards away. We both stood up and were looking, trying to figure out what we were seeing, and it seemed to be getting closer. Pretty soon you could see the shape of a person walking towards us, its arms and legs both moving. We both stared, absolutely stunned, until it got about halfway to us, 50 or so yards, I guess, maybe even a little closer. I can't emphasize enough how puzzled, I guess is the word, I was. I wasn't scared at all, just couldn't figure out what I was seeing. It was an opaque, three-dimensional silhouette of a man made entirely of blue light. It even looked to be carrying something in one hand. Anyway, April snapped out of it first and yelled, "Run!" then took off towards the way we'd come in. I started to run and trip. It was very dark out there. We had flashlights and hit the ground hard. I got up and looked back. Right beside the place where we were sitting was a deer skull, some candles, and a homemade Ouija board. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I know this because we went back the next morning. I saw very briefly that night, I assure you. Anyway, I jumped up as fast as I could and ran to catch April. We had to slow down to make it back to our house through the woods. It was very grown up, lots of thorns. We heard footsteps behind us the whole walk back, longest 15-minute hike I've ever been on. Like I mentioned above, we went back the next day and were surprised to see the skull, etc. The Ouija board was kind of impressive. Someone took a lot of time to carve it, and it was huge. It folded in the middle like a chessboard and had a triangular-shaped rock as a pointer. There were candles all around and a few more animal skulls and skeleton, but that's all we found. Since then, I've asked lots of people if they know anything about the place. No one knows anything beyond, "I heard that it's haunted." By whom or what, no one knows. Next story. I was driving home from work. It was a night shift, and it was just after 6 a.m. Still very dark outside. My ride home from work is about 20 minutes, all back roads that are very dark and mostly wooded. Up ahead at the edge of my headlights, I saw movement. As I got closer, I saw this very large muscular dude with no shirt on. It was maybe 45 degrees out, so it seemed strange that he wouldn't even have a shirt. He also had an inverted cross painted on his chest and black makeup around his eyes. Behind him was a guy I didn't get a good look at, but it seemed he was wearing a lab coat. There was a third figure in the woods next to them, but I didn't get a look at him at all. I hadn't slept much all weekend and was very tired, so I didn't feel like dealing with calling the cops or anything. It was a Sunday morning before Halloween, so I assumed they were at a party the night before and crashed there and must be walking home. In hindsight, and after getting scolded by my cop wife when I told her, I probably should have stopped and asked if they were okay and at least checked out the situation. Like I said, it was a wooded back road that had a few isolated houses on it. They may have been walking home to one of those houses or whatever, but it was creepy. If I saw the large shirtless guy walking towards me on a dark road anytime but Halloween, I would most definitely have drawn my pistol. He was large enough to be a professional wrestler, and I have never seen him around town before. I would have remembered a guy like that. Next story. This isn't my story. It happened to my dad, my uncle, and my grandpa. I've had independent confirmation from all three as well as some of the other guys in this story. This took place in the early 90s, and my dad and the guys he was hunting with at the time were looking for a place to stay near the land they'd leased. Somebody heard about a big house sitting empty, and they called up and rented it. It was a very large house built right after the Civil War near Selma, Alabama. Anyway, now to the good stuff. Like I said before, the house was big. There was about 8 guys altogether, and they set up 2 bunk beds in bedrooms right across the hall from each other. Both my dad and uncle told me the house was always freezing no matter how many space heaters they used, so they all kind of stayed in the same small area and didn't use the rest of the house. The first night, everyone came back from hunting all day and went to sleep until 3 a.m. when an extremely loud bang woke everyone up. My uncle said he thought a car had run off the road and hit the house. They all went to check and nothing. Everyone kind of shrugged it off and went back to bed. The next night, the same thing happened at exactly the same time. They all ran out to the source of the noise and found nothing. They all swore this happened every single night they stayed there. Another weird thing that happened to them when they were there was having to do with the bedrooms. Well, one of the bedrooms, at least. It had a closet door that opened every time the room was empty. My grandpa was bunked in this room. He told me you could put a chair against the doorknob, and as long as you were in the room, it didn't move. But if you left for a couple of seconds, the chair would be moved and the door standing open again. In that same room, they had a couple of nails on the wall to hang clothes from, and if you left the room, they would be soaked when you returned. It didn't take long for the guys to stop staying in the house. At first, it was a couple. Then they were down to 4. My dad invited a friend of his one weekend and didn't tell him any of these stories. They hunted all day and went to bed, and my dad was woken up in the middle of the night by his friend urgently whispering his name from across the room. He looked up and saw the door handle shaking like someone was trying to get in. Then the door pushed open slowly. Then the most unbelievable part, the sound of footsteps running away and a child's laughter. My dad got up, looked down the hall, and saw there were drops of water going in the direction of the footsteps that ended in a puddle. My dad's friend went out and slept the rest of the night in his truck. That's all I can remember, and I don't think I'm leaving anything out. I've been told these stories for years now by all three of them, all of whom I unquestionably believe. My dad still says he doesn't believe in ghosts, but will admit that there's something there. My uncle got religion a few years later and won't talk about it anymore. My grandpa would tell me the story anytime I asked until he passed away. I even have a good ending that sort of explains things. When the season was over, my dad went to take the keys back to the owners, an elderly couple that lived a few miles down the road. He thanked her for letting them stay, and she told him, "I can't believe you all slept up there. We've owned that house for years, and I won't set foot in it unless it's in the daytime." She went on to tell my dad the story that before the house was built, there was a school on the property, with a well directly under where the house is now. She had been told that a little boy fell in and drowned. Next story. This story I was told many years ago when I was 16, told to me by the woman who became my first mother-in-law. She reported hearing it in past from her grandparents. It occurred in the Missouri-Arkansas-Ozark area. Her people lived on both sides of the line, and I'm unsure where this took place. My mother-in-law believed every word of it and passed it on as the truth. It occurred in the 1870s. Scenes back during the bleak years after the war between the states, a young woman was found in the woods near an Ozark settlement, weeping hysterically. She'd been roughed up and, although very beautiful, was in an unkempt shape. Dirty and torn clothes, bruises, leaves and sticks in her tangled hair, a wild look of fear in her pale green eyes. To their kind questions, all she could choke out between sobs was, "Church, take me to church. He's going to come back and get me." So to the church they went, gathering the preacher and the neighbors for an impromptu service. All during the church service, the woman sat, eyes cast on the ground, weeping without ceasing, as the older women tried to comfort her and the pastor did his best to rout her fears. The service concluded with the stranger still sobbing and occasionally muttering, "He will come for me." A heavy uneasiness spread over the congregation. Nervous glances exchanged and children pulled close. Finally it was over and it was decided who would take the pitiful girl home with them. They told her the plan, but her eyes were now glassy and she didn't respond. The congregation left the old one-room log church, each person solemnly shaking the pastor's hand. When all were out in the churchyard, the evening was still with twilight shadows lengthening. Suddenly a sound like a million bees filled the air. People looked wildly about them as the sound seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere at the same time. A woman screamed as a dark blob materialized from the sky dressed in a black, a lone masked rider on a huge black horse. This phantom swept down from the clouds, plucked the stranger from their midst, and disappeared. That's it. As I said, it was told as the absolute truth. It sounds like a cautionary tale to tell young women to keep them at Sunday school and away from dark strangers, but who knows? Next story. Here's one told to me by my friend's uncle. It supposedly happened to him and another guy in the late 70s, early 80s. So my friend's uncle Bob and his two friends leased some land in southern Alabama to hunt deer. According to Bob, it was around 900 acres altogether, so they had a good bit of land to wander around on between three people. They used an old pre-existing house as a camp, and the property had old roads going all through it, and a couple of old home sites with chimneys still remaining, and one small graveyard. The two stories I can remember, it's been a long time since I've heard them, only concern Bob and his friend Joe, so I'll leave the other guy out now. Anyway, on to the stories. This one is short and kind of creepy to imagine seeing yourself. Joe had gone into the woods before daylight and climbed up into his tree stand. He was just sitting up there and waiting, with just enough light to see out 50 or so yards ahead of him, when he catches movement out of the corner of his eye. He turns to look and can see one of the old road beds through the trees and something walking. He looked through his scope and swore he saw an old woman in a thin house dress making her way slowly down the road. Joe said he sat there for a second, not believing what he was seeing. There were no houses close by, and none of the roads connected to outside the property. Also, it was freezing and just barely daylight. Then he decided, despite the fact he was suddenly overcome with dread and fear, that's the way he put it, Bob apparently, dread like it hit him out of nowhere, that he had to go and help this old woman. He climbed down and ran over to where he'd just seen her walking, and nothing. She was gone, without a trace, and Joe decided not to hunt that spot anymore. The second story is weirder. Bob was at the house alone. His friends were on their way, but not expected for another few hours. Bob was sitting in the kitchen around 9 o'clock at night, drinking coffee, when he heard pounding on the front door and a woman screaming, "Help me! Let me in!" Bob ran to the door and opened it, and the woman bolted in, screaming, "Lock the door! They're after me and want to kill me!" Bob locked the door and looked outside, but couldn't see anything, so he took the woman to the kitchen, gave her some coffee to drink, and tried to get the story. The woman said her name was Mary and that she had been walking home, was pulled into a truck with two men who had taken her down a back road, hit her, threatened to cut her throat, and said they were going to rape her. She escaped somehow and ran in the woods until she was brought there. Those were her exact words. After telling Bob all the above, she went silent, just staring down at her coffee and not responding to anything Bob said. Bob was worried about the guides following, and he had no phone out there, but he had a rifle and a pistol and kept checking outside but never heard anything. He sat at the table with a woman who remained unresponsive and smoked cigarettes and drank coffee for a couple of hours. He said she just stared at her cup with a blank expression the whole time. After the initial shock had worn off, Bob said he noticed that her clothes were odd. They looked like something from the 50s, but couldn't get her to say anything. finally saw headlights outside. He ran to the front door and looked out and saw that it was his friend. So he opened the door to go and tell them about the situation inside. When they all went in, she was gone, only her coffee cup sitting on the table. According to Bob, there was no other way out of the cabin except the front door, and nobody had seen her come out. They called for her and looked around, but never saw her again. Bob, of course, called the police the next day, but never heard anything else about it. He personally thought that she was the ghost of a woman that had all of these things done to her, but hadn't escaped, and was for some reason drawn to the cabin. He said lots of weird things happened on that property.